Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We are in a rich time for documentary films, with platforms like Netflix and Amazon making it easier to watch documentaries and vivid storylines. The format is flourishing. This year's crop, vying for the Academy Award for Best Documentary, makes the case. The five nominated films focus on stories of race, prison, migrant peril, O.J. Simpson, and autism. This hour On Point, we're checking out the Oscar-nominated documentaries. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are we in a golden age for documentary filmmaking? What do you look for in a good, great documentary these days? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll think again about Mary Tyler Moore, dead this week at 80. But first, Oscar-nominated documentaries. Joining me from Los Angeles via Skype is Ann Thompson, editor-at-large for IndieWire, author of The $11 Billion Year from Sundance to the Oscars, an inside look at the changing Hollywood system. Ann Thompson, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hey, Tom.
And from Culver City, California, Sean Edwards joins us, co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association, creator of ILoveBlackMovies.com. He's film critic for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri. Sean Edwards, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Hey, thanks a lot, Tom. Appreciate it.
And we've got five films that have a lot of buzz here, documentary films. And this is in a year when there's plenty of buzz also for La La Land and Moonlight and right on down that big list of feature films. But what about the crop this year, Anne, is getting so much attention and buzz on the documentary front?
Well, I think Netflix really is making a big difference. We're in a golden age of documentaries where all these people, I was just coming from the Sundance Film Festival, and, you know, there were bidding wars for these movies. You know, a four-hour Grateful Dead movie goes to Amazon, you know. They can slice and dice it however they want. They don't have to play by the same rules.
Remind us why that's remarkable, or you know, we hear you almost laughing in dismay at that, and remind us why that's so, Ann.
I'm happy. I'm very happy. And I think if you have Netflix, you can have Making a Murderer, wouldn't have gotten made, was being passed on by other companies. And you can have at ESPN this remarkable O.J. Made in America, which is probably the likely winner. But, you know, it's stirring up controversy because how do you define a feature film? Is it a two-hour documentary in a theater, or is it being played on these multi-platforms around the world?
All kinds of platforms for these to emerge on now. Sean Edwards, when you step back and look at these five films, Oscar-nominated documentaries, four of them directed by people of color this year, after the Oscars have had so much criticism on that front over years. But these five films, what do you make of the general quality and why there's so much buzz, Sean?
Well, I think the overall quality is outstanding. In fact, I would say that the five movies nominated for Best Documentary are better than the nine movies nominated for Best Picture. That's my biggest pet peeve with the Academy Awards, is I don't understand what the true definition of Best Picture really is, because I would put these five documentaries up against La La Land or any of the other movies nominated for Best Picture anytime, because these are the most fascinating movies I saw all year and are truly better than the nine.
I mean, that's an interesting question, but isn't Best Picture usually fiction, because Hollywood's supposed to be the dream factory, Sean, and documentaries are supposed to document life?
Well, I think the Academy stuck on what they consider a Best Picture to be, because it's usually one type of picture that only wins Best Picture. They never really take in consideration if an animated feature is truly great, or if a documentary is memorable, or even if a certain type of feature film is great. I mean, we sort of get stuck in a box, and they get stuck in this box on what we really consider a Best Picture to be. And I think now that we have these emerging new genres, I think that may change over time, but I would definitely like to see the Best Picture category shaken up, because these five definitely qualify as one of the best movies of the year.
Brief summaries here, if you can help us do this. Fire at Sea, Ann Thompson, one of the five. This is directed by Gianfranco Rossi, and this is about migrants fleeing Africa and the Middle East, making their first stop on a Sicilian island. And we've all seen the pictures for several years now, these overcrowded boats swamped in the Mediterranean. What's the story in Fire at Sea?
What he does is, and he's a cinematographer, so he really does it by himself. He spent a whole year on Lampedusa, and he creates a parallel narrative between these boats coming in, and he actually goes in and films in the hold of one of these boats in a chilling scene full of death. Very, very sad. And he also tells a story of a young boy who's living a normal life, who, you know, going to the doctor and getting treated and being, you know, cooking in the kitchen with his mom. And it's very poetic and very, very devastating.
A 13th. This is directed by Ana DuVernay. Of course, 2014 feature film Selma was so big, got so much attention. What's being documented in 13th, Sean?
Well, The 13th is an amazing documentary directed by Ava DuVernay. And what it does best is it sort of gives an unflinching look at America's criminal justice system, with the backdrop being mass incarceration in America, as it specifically deals with over African-Americans and how they're sort of over-penalized in America's justice system. But the one hidden thing that it brilliantly does is it demonstrates how all of this was a strategy which came to life with the Southern strategy, and shows that there's been a history in America, and this was sort of like a planned attack against African-Americans, specifically African-American males, on coming up with laws and creating situations in which millions and millions of black men have been dumped into penitentiaries, which goes all the way back to the days of slavery.
Draws that line from slavery to mass incarceration today. Life Animated, directed by Roger Ross Williams, Anne. And this, the story, what, of journalist Ron Suskind's son, Owen, who stopped talking about after he turned 3, was diagnosed with autism, but started understanding the world through Disney animated films. Kind of incredible story. He really comes out via Disney, Anne.
Yes, and Roger Ross Williams does a remarkable job of getting him to come out to the camera, and he devised ways to film him and show him coming of age, growing into a young man, moving into his own home, having a girlfriend, and he uses animation to bring his ideas and his dreams and his thoughts to life, and it's just a must-see documentary.
And then Raoul Peck's documentary, I Am Not Your Negro. Sean Edwards, tell us about it.
Well, more than any of the documentaries in this category, this one took my breath away more. It made me weep the most. It's just a fascinating piece of work. It's based on James Baldwin's unfinished novel,
Remember This
title,
Hour.
Right, Remember This House. Remember This House. Remember This House. And what this documentary does brilliantly is it sort of finishes his narrative, and it's fantastic, and it actually uses excerpts and clips of James Baldwin talking about race relations in America and talking about his personal relationship with Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, and Martin Luther King, with whom he was best friends. And what this really brilliantly does, it really sums up where we have been with race relations and where we are now, and really demonstrates that not a lot has changed. And I would love to see James Baldwin, if he were still alive today, be on air with any of the national news channel anchors, go toe-to-toe over subjects of immigration and race and or whatever, because he was such a brilliant orator, and he would have sliced and diced these people to death today.
Indeed.
Here's a little bit from the trailer of I Am Not Your Negro. And, I mean, hold on here, because James Baldwin did not mince words. It's directed by Raoul Peck. This is the actual voice of James Baldwin from the documentary, and he's talking about the N-word and the idea behind the N-word and why some people might need that idea. And a warning, he doesn't say N-word here.
The question you've got to ask yourself, the white population of this country's got to ask itself, is why it was necessary to have a nigger in the first place. Because I'm not a nigger. I'm a man. But if you think I'm a nigger, it means you need it. And you got to find out why. And the future of the country depends on that.
If you think I'm that, you need that. Sean Edwards, this goes deep. Of course it's deep as James Baldwin, but it is right at the heart of this film.
No, it's definitely at the heart of this film, and it's definitely at where we are with the, you know, with the history of race relations, whether you're talking about in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s, or right now, because there's a lot of footage woven in this documentary of what happened in Ferguson, Missouri. So it deals with the right now, it deals with the back then, and it really raises a lot of interesting questions on just how far we've come as people in this country when it deals with how we get along culturally and as different races.
And it's so interesting that these films with these directors would come to the fore at this time when we'd just come out of a presidential campaign season where race was such a heavy presence there. And these documentaries sort of lighting our country up in a quite different way from, let's say, a Trump rally.
All right. We did have Oscars So White last year. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences was devastated by this. They were
the criticism that they were so lily white. Get over yourselves, please. It's
there were
time.
No people of color in all the acting races. And so while the documentary side has certainly been a little more politically correct over the years, this is amazing to have four out of the five nominees like this. And so I think they're making a statement. They made a statement across the board with the Oscar nominations. There were some 18 that were somehow people of color over the entire list of nominees. So what I'm curious to see, I didn't think they would do all four. That's what really sort of surprised me. They are utterly deserving. All of them. Ava DuVernay is the only woman, though,
nominated. We're going to dive right into the five Oscar-nominated documentaries here in this hour with Ann Thompson from IndieWire, editor-at-large there in Los Angeles, Sean Edwards with Fox 4 News and the African American Film Critics Association. This is Letter to the Free Common for 13th. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
The caged bird sings for freedom to ring. Black bodies being lost in the American dream. Blood a black being, a pastoral scene. Slavery still alive, check Amendment 13. Not whips and chains, our subliminal. Instead of... they used the word criminal. Sweet land of liberty, incarcerated country. Shot me with your ray gun and now you wanna trump me. Prison is a business, America's the company. Investing in the justice, fear and long suffering. We staring in the face of hate again. The same hate they say will make America great again. No consolation prize for the dehumanized. For America to rise, it's a matter of black lives. And we gon' free them so we can free us. America's moment to come to Jesus.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we are talking this hour about the strong lineup of documentaries nominated for Oscars this year. Maybe this year, the toughest competition category in the Academy Awards, with race, migration, autism front and center here. Sean Edwards is with us, creator of ILoveBlackMovies.com, film critic for Fox 4 News in Kansas City, Missouri, joins us today from Culver City, California. Ann Thompson is here, editor-at-large at IndieWire, author of the $11 billion year. You can join us as well. Have you seen these films? Fire at Sea, I Am Not Your Negro, OJ, Made in America, 13th, Life Animated. With all the access online, are you watching more documentaries these days? With all the video out there these days, citizen video, do documentaries still matter? With their focus and depth, do they matter more today? Fire at Sea, and Ann, you began to describe it a little bit for us, but this is about migrants coming across from North Africa, stranded on an island off of Sicily, and the sort of high drama of behind those photos and video that we have all seen from the news of these overloaded boats and desperate people trying to make it north. That ongoing migrant crisis traveling across the Mediterranean to Italy. Here's a clip from the film. It's a distress call from 250 stranded migrants at sea begging the Italian Navy for rescue.
How many people?
Please.
How many people?
250.
Your position.
There is in danger. Please, you beg, you please, save us.
Your position.
In the name of God.
Your position.
Begging for something there. And then another scene in which a group of recently arrived migrants from Nigeria are gathered in prayer in Fire at Sea. One of them gives his testimony on what led him to make the dangerous journey.
This is my testimony. We could no longer stay in Nigeria. Many were dying. Mosques were bombed. Churches were bombed. And we flee from Nigeria. We ran to the desert. We were Shahada desert and many died.
We flee. We run through the desert. Sean Edwards, what did you see? What did you feel watching Fire at Sea?
Well, number one, out of the five documentaries, the cinematography is just gorgeous. And then the impact of what you're seeing really forces you to take a second look at the whole issue of immigration, because it's such a powerful and emotional film that you instantly connect with the plight of the people, and you get like a full understanding of what they're going through and the reason why. Because I think when a lot of people deal with the issue of immigration, they don't look at it from a 360 perspective. They don't understand the totality of the situation. And this documentary does a fantastic job of doing that. So if you were for integration, you have a better appreciation. If you didn't understand integration, you have a better knowledge. And that's what this film does best.
I guess to be taken, as you say, kind of into the hull here, we can all picture from the shots we've seen how frightening it must be. But this takes us deeper into the drama.
Well, it's really because it's a documentary. This is a man with a camera going down into the hold and showing you the piles of bodies. And it took courage for him to even go there. And he did it. And we've seen it now. And it will never be erased from our memory.
Let's go to Evan calling from Viroqua, Wisconsin. Evan, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just want to tell you that I have watched many documentaries recently. Only one of the Oscar-nominated ones, 13th, and I did like it quite a bit. I thought it was very interesting to watch visually, and also the way they kind of tied all the authorities. They kind of had they spoke as one voice. But I will say that the you asked kind of what I like in a documentary, and I will say that I watch documentaries, and you know, it's like they're about race, or they're about fuel or frac sand mining, or about our food system, or they're about adolescence or gender identity, and there's all these hard subjects, and they tend to make me sad, or they're angry, or I'm guilty for inaction, or I'm moved to like make a really difficult change in my life. And I think to a documentary I saw some years ago called 20 Feet from Stardom about
backup singers. Yeah.
And I felt
none
of
the Oscar?
It was joyful.
Joyful, yes, it was. It was amazing, and as Anne says, won the Oscar. So the stars aligned right there, Evan. But you want to feel something as well as learn something in these documentaries.
Indeed, yeah.
Did you end up feeling in 13th? I mean, it's telling a story out of history from slavery and the Civil War to mass incarceration. Now, what about the feeling side, Evan?
Yeah, definitely feelings of sadness and, I guess we call it white guilt, I guess. In addition, moved to, what can I do to make things better?
Yeah. Evan, I appreciate your call. Let's listen to a little bit from Ava DuVernay's documentary, 13th. Makes the argument that there's a direct line from slavery to mass incarceration today, featuring interviews, and here you'll hear some with prominent historians like Michelle Alexander, Kevin Gannon, Henry Louis Gates Jr.
After the Civil War, African Americans were arrested en masse. It was our nation's first prison boom.
You were basically a slave again. The 13th Amendment says that, hey, except for criminals, everybody else is free. Well, now if you're criminalized, that doesn't apply to you.
They were arrested for extremely minor crimes like loitering or vagrancy.
And they had to provide labor to rebuild the economy of the South after the Civil War.
From Ava DuVernay's 13th, and it's not just history. She brings it right up to date, very contemporary. Here's lawyer activist in the film, the documentary Van Jones featured. He and the film argue that black communities are still in chains.
They called the end of slavery Jubilee. We thought we were done then. And then you had 100 years of Jim Crow terror and lynching. Dr. King, these guys come on the scene, Ella Jo Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer. We get the bills passed to vote, and then they break out the handcuffs. Label you felon, you can't vote or get a job.
There you go, Van Jones. Ann Thompson, we saw Ava DuVernay's work in Selma. Can you feel the same directorial impulse at work in the documentary as we saw in that theatrical recreation of the history of the Civil Rights March there?
Yeah, DuVernay has a background in documentaries, and she worked closely with Netflix on shaping this narrative, making it a revisionist history, a way of looking at our past that we'd never thought of before. And it's really well done, and she uses graphics and not only talking heads, but visuals to, you know, clips from Birth of a Nation, the original D.W. Griffith, and just to show, and it's interesting because the Raoul Peck movie and this movie are both showing that criminalization of the African-American man in our mind's eye. And it's a question of creating this horrible sort of boogeyman, scary person that we should shy away from and be frightened of. And Hollywood has perpetuated that, too, over the years.
Raoul Peck's, of course, I'm Not Your Negro. Jake in Waterbury, Vermont. Jake, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
One thing that I've been noticing about the evolution of these documentaries, especially as they become more appealing and more successful on various platforms, is there was often this idea that to document something was meant to be this academic or dispassionate and detached idea of presenting something, and then as time went on and the medium became more artistic, it became much more acceptable for the documentary to have a very specific perspective or opinion, and in many cases to wear that on its sleeve and not necessarily to be presenting an issue so much as making an argument. And I'm wondering if that has led to the much stronger response that we see to documentaries now, that directors have much more leeway to make the argument in an artistic fashion as opposed to trying to neutrally document.
It's a great question, and I'll put it to Anne and Sean. Have you seen some of the crop this year, Jake?
Yes, I did see O.J. Made in America, Life Animated, and 13th.
And
what he's saying is very true, I would say. Yeah. And I think that Michael Moore, of course, is the pioneer of this kind of more personal journalism. But what's going on, too, is that journalists are taking on topics and digging into things that the conventional media are not. And I think they've become more important than ever. And that feeling that they were going to go after Trump, the world of Trump, there were a lot of documentaries at Sundance that really you could see had changed in flavor after the election, and I think we'll see more of that too.
I want to get just a little.
I just want to weigh in on this, but because there's been a lot said about the quality, I think that's a little unfair. There have been great documentaries for years. I think the reason why there are more people are paying more attention to documentaries because it's much easier to find them and watch them now. There have always been great documentaries. Every year, there's tons and tons and tons of great documentaries done in different sorts of creative ways. But because of Netflix and Amazon, you can watch them on your phone. You can watch them on your iPad. They're much more easier to find. You don't have to wait for them to be released theatrically because there are a lot of cities that don't have movie theaters that show these type of movies. You'd have to live in a New York or LA or San Francisco in the past in order to watch a documentary. Now you can basically live on the moon and watch every documentary ever created right at your fingertips. So that's why there's such this explosion and the reason why we're paying more detail to these types of movies. But there always have been great documentaries. So I don't want to take that away from all the documentarians who have produced quality work for years.
Accessibility, a huge issue here. But I'm
interested. That's the key, accessibility.
Yep, but also this question of whether there's more opinion now and how that changes the draw of documentaries. Let me hold that question. Let's just listen to a little bit from O.J. Made in America. This is 8 hours long, ESPN, and there's still plenty of just straight-up documentary material here, including this incredible recording of a phone call that O.J. Simpson made on June 17th, 1994, the same day he surrendered to authorities for the murder of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, after a nearly two-hour car chase in that white Ford Bronco through the streets and freeways of Los Angeles. Here's O.J. on the phone.
I don't know how I ended up here. I just don't know how I ended up here. I thought I lived a great life. I thought I treated everybody well. I went out of my way to make everybody comfortable and happy. I felt the goodness in myself and the goodness that I gave people. I don't feel any goodness in myself right now. I feel empty. I feel totally empty. But I felt I had something in my ass thing I gotta say to somebody. Please remember me as a Jew. Please remember me as a good guy.
Kind of incredible, just that phone call from OJ after the white Bronco chase was over. Sean Edwards and Ann Thompson, please stand by in California. Ralph Béliveau joins us right now, Associate Professor of Creative Media Production, University of Oklahoma, and his work focuses on, among other things, documentary production and history and popular culture. Ralph Béliveau, thanks very much for being with us for a minute today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So the caller says he feels like there's more opinion in documentaries these days than in the past, and that may make them more gripping. What do you think of that observation?
Well, it's interesting because I think we went through a period post-World War II where documentaries got to be very journalistic. Previous to that, a lot of the people who started documentary in Canada and the UK were very interested in using it as a persuasive form, and that happened in the U.S. too. A lot of the World War II documentaries were really propaganda that were made in the U.S. Mm. But then we went through a period after World War II and up through the 60s and early 70s where documentary was very journalistic-centered. The rise of network television supported that. But as Sean was saying, there were always amazing documentaries being produced. They just weren't getting the same kind of attention. And they were using a more persuasive rhetorical mode to do what they were doing. So I think we've returned to that, and I'm delighted to see that.
As a scholar of documentary making, is the more persuasive mode welcome to you? I guess you're saying yes. But what about the idea that documentary would be more, just the facts, ma'am?
Well, I think the audience is a lot smarter about it, too, because they've seen a lot more. Over the years that I've been teaching, my students have seen a lot more documentaries and a lot more savvy about the techniques that are going on inside of them. The trick is to do things like watch things twice and think about how you're being manipulated. Even if it's something you agree with, what kind of manipulative techniques are being used to get you to, you know, agree with the argument that's being made. And then once you're done with it, to kind of reflect on it and think, okay, you know, where were my buttons being pushed? What was I being shown? Yeah.
Let's go to Asia in Cleveland Heights, Ohio. Asia, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was calling to say I agree that access has a lot to do with the popularity of documentary films. I am 31 years old, so that makes me on the tail end of a millennial, and I've been watching documentaries for many years. But what I noticed that's different now is I saw 13th right away. Most of my friends have seen 13th, even my friends that would never watch a documentary, just because it's on Netflix. So I do think that access makes a huge difference. And then I also wanted to say that in 2009, I remember watching Collapse, the documentary, and I thought that there was a lot of opinion-making going on at that time. And I wouldn't necessarily say that films are more opinion-based now than they were at that time. I just think that we're in a new era.
A new era. Asia, I appreciate your call. Sean, if there's a new era, how would you describe it here around documentaries?
Well, there is sort of a new era because there's sort of like this fresh voice where you take someone like an Ava DuVernay who has like a distinct style. So I think stylistically, we're sort of seeing a change with documentarians. But the one thing I would like to say is when we were talking about, you know, documentaries that push buttons or create emotions, that's the beautiful thing about OJ Made in America and what makes that documentary so great. It doesn't push any buttons. It's just a straight fact machine. Because OJ is the one thing where most people of a certain age think they know every single thing they could possibly know about OJ and that trial. And this documentary amazingly discovers new material and presents OJ in a completely different perspective. So you understand OJ, you know, pre-trial, post-trial, during the trial, you know, how he became to become the man that he is. I mean, it does that so beautifully, which makes this one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. I know it has an unfair advantage because it's 467 minutes long, but it's still, you know, if the Academy was worth anything, this movie would have been nominated for Best Picture, Best Editing, Best Score, and definitely Best Editing. I can't even imagine the task that the editors had putting this thing together.
8 hours of OJ. Incredible that we still have the appetite for that, but it is still such a riveting American story. Sean Edwards with Fox 4 News, Kansas City, Missouri. Please stand by there in Culver City, California today. Ann Thompson with IndieWire. Ralph Béliveau, University of Oklahoma, with us today from Chicago. Yeah, we've got heavy race stuff and also Disney movies through Life Animated, the story of an autistic boy, kind of freed, liberated, brought to life through those movies. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm ready to know.
questions and get some answers. What's a fire and why does it, what's the word, learn? When's it my turn? Wouldn't I love to explore that shore up above? Out of the sea, wish I could be part of that world.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/onpoint.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the strong lineup of documentaries nominated for Oscars this year. Five Oscar nominated, and they are getting lots of attention. Fire at Sea, Life Animated, O.J. Made in America, I Am Not Your Negro, 13th, directed by Ava DuVernay. Sean Edwards is with us to look at these out of Fox 4 News, Kansas City. Ann Thompson from IndieWire, Ralph Beliveau from University of Oklahoma, associate professor there, joins us from Chicago today. We're going to talk about Mary Tyler Moore before this hour is over, but just a little more, and we're so happy to do it on this great crop of documentaries. Lots of listeners here chiming in on Twitter and Facebook. Cynthia says, I saw 13th and had my entire family, ages 10 to 44, watch it. All ages, races, lifestyle, she said, that might have us believe we're post-racial. I think this film should be shown in high schools around the country. Truly eye-opening. Terry says, I like documentaries based on facts that challenge my beliefs and knowledge, makes me a better thinker, that kind of devil's advocate role of the documentary. And Jim says, Holly Weird has lost all intellectual creativity, suggesting that maybe documentaries have it now. Asia called from Cleveland Heights, talking about 13th from Ava DuVernay. Here's a moment featured in the documentary from the early 1970s, when a reporter asks the activist Professor Angela Davis about using violence to achieve social justice.
I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. After the four young girls who lived next door to me. I was very good friends with the sister of another one. My sister was very good friends with all three of them. My mother taught one of them in her class, and they went down, and what did they find? They found limbs and heads strewn all over the place. I remember from the time I was very small, I remember the sounds of bombs exploding across the street, our house shaking. I remember my father having to have guns at his disposal at all times because of the fact that at any moment someone we might expect to be attacked. I mean, that's why when someone asked me about violence, I just find it incredible. What it means is that the person who's asking that question has absolutely no idea what black people have gone through, what black people have experienced in this country since the time the first black person was kidnapped from the shores of Africa.
Potent, crackling, historical sound there from Ava DuVernay's documentary 13th. Joe in Detroit, thank you for calling, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a Detroit, Michigan native, but I was an educator. I worked under a LAUSD contract in Compton, South Central, for 1 year with middle school.
Yeah.
Very in touch with the struggles of education. Saw 13, I saw the interview with Oprah, then I saw the actual documentary. I've watched it like three times. Heartbreaking. Heartbreaking. I would say my comment is that as honest and truthful as it was and broke my heart, I'm a white guy trying to help people who are trying to get out of poverty. It was very one-dimensional, like Michael Moore, and I think incredibly divisive because of the darkness and the truth. It makes white people look really bad that are really bad, but it really puts a bad light on the culture, and I think there's enough division, but I really respect the truth that came out of it, but it's heartbreaking, and I don't think it's, not that the purpose was to be unifying, but very, very dark versus the white culture.
Joe, I really appreciate your call. Sean, your response there, is this hard truth? Well, what about divisiveness?
It's not divisive when it's real life. I'm a black male, and you know, I've been stopped by the cops. I've been thrown in jail for no reason. I have no sympathy for that, because everything is documented in the 13th is an actuality. I'm living proof. I'm a witness of it. And if that's the hard proof, America's got to deal with it. America created this situation. Ava DuVernay just documented it.
Ralph, is that the documentary's role? No matter how hard, just put it right there and let the chips fall where they may?
Well, I think one of the things that works especially well in that film is the fact that it reveals some of the coding that went on, so that things that were really critical
exactly.
racial issues were kind of buried under the war on drugs and under, you know, the cry for law and order. And so it really, to me, again, it's got a really strong historical line that points out how central race is to understanding pretty much anything about the way America's developed in its history.
No rose garden there in Ava DuVernay's 13th, but real, all too real. I want to get just a little bit of life animated. This documentary, directed by Roger Ross Williams, based on a book by journalist Ron Suskind, and it follows his son, Owen Suskind, autistic, who as a child learned to communicate through watching Disney animations. And here's the moment from Life Animated where his dad, Ron Suskind, figured out what was going on.
So I go up to his room. I see Owen on the bed flipping through a Disney book. And I see, sort of over to my left, I see Iago, the puppet. Now, Iago is the evil sidekick to the villain Jafar from Aladdin. Now, I know Owen loves his puppet.
Jafar! Jafar! Get a grip!
I grab the puppet, I pull it up to my elbow, and I begin to crawl across the rug as quietly as I can. And Owen turns to the puppet like he's bumping into an old friend. I say to him, Owen, how does it feel to be you?
And I said, not good, because I don't have any friends.
Now I'm under the bedspread, and I just bite down hard. You know, I just say to myself, stay in character. And I say, okay, Owen, when did you and I become such good friends? And he said, when I watched Aladdin, you made me laugh. And then we talk, Owen and Iago, for a minute and a half. It's the first conversation we've ever had.
From Life Animated, Ann Thompson, how does this film, the sort of Disney-themed freeing of an autistic boy then to man, how does it stand up against these heavy historical documentaries that we see next to it?
Well, it reveals the power of film, you know, to communicate, mm-hmm. to break through barriers. And I just got very emotional listening to this. This is a movie that isn't like any other. And that's one of the reasons why it broke through and wound up in the final five. It shows ingenuity. It shows a kind of ability to communicate with the subject that if he hadn't been able to figure out how to get the kid to go straight to the camera, we wouldn't have had a movie. And so they rewarded him for this.
Ralph Béliveau, it is exciting to see this crop of documentaries raising so many questions in people's minds and hearts, moving people, enlightening people. It's kind of thrilling.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, we've also turned our living rooms into movie theaters, and all of these media are converging. So, you know, we're having a theatrical experience at home if we're, you know, fortunate and privileged enough to have, you know, good equipment, basically. And a lot of it's available now and access is there. So, you know, we've kind of taken that theatrical experience and moved it into our house. And that's a very emotionally resonant thing. And, you know, that's part of the whole access trend that we've seen that's made people so much more on top of what they're seeing when they're watching documentaries.
Sean Edwards, how are you guessing the Academy will come at these five? How are they going to? What's the dynamic of choosing a winner out of these?
No, it's going to be tough, but I would like to add quickly that Roger Ross Williams is the only previous Academy Award-winning director in this category. He won for a documentary short movie called music by Prudence. Mm-hmm. So he has that pedigree. But in terms of choosing a winner, it's going to be difficult. But I would go with O.J. Made in America just because it's so expansive and so well done.
Listeners, Ann Thompson is right there as well. Ralph Béliveau, it's great to have you with us today, all three. What a great fact that we have this kind of beautiful, deep production in all five right in front of us this year. Ann Thompson with IndieWire. Thanks, as always, for joining us, Ann.
My pleasure.
Sean Edwards, it's been great getting to know you. Please come again. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Had a great time.
And Ralph Béliveau, University of Oklahoma. Thank you so much, Ralph.
Oh, thank you.
In a moment, we'll remember Mary Tyler Moore and how the way she nimbly navigated a Minneapolis newsroom full of male colleagues showcased a positive example of workplace success for women. This is On Point.
Can turn the world on with her smile.
Mary Tyler Moore, the spunky, sassy, energetic actress best known for her television roles as Dick Van Dyke's wife and the Minneapolis news producer on her eponymous show, died Wednesday at the age of 80. We're going to look at how her work shaped a new perception of women in the workplace. Joining me now from Olympia, Washington, is Stephanie Kuntz, professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College. She's also director of research and public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. She's used clips from the Mary Tyler Moore Show in her classes to show how pervasive the pressure was for women to get married and not earn their own money. Stephanie Kuntz, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Did your students get it when you showed them clips from Mary Tyler Moore? I mean, that no doubt produced well before they were born. Did they get what the big deal was?
No, they didn't. It had to be explained to them. I was shocked because, you know, I was in my 20s, pushing that magic age of 25, which they used to call Christmas cake. It won't be taken off the shelf
after that. Yeah, 25th. Yeah.
So I loved it, but they didn't really like the show at first. I showed it without any previous shows from the era, and they said, "Well, she's too cute, she's too nervous, she's timid, she gets her way. She does get her way. She stands up for herself, but she never stands up directly, you know, she seldom does." So I was just like flummoxed. We had to start back, and I had to explain to them why it had meant so much to my generation to see a woman in that position at all and not being run out of it by being sexually harassed or bossed around or just fired.
Let's listen to just a little bit of that. That is kind of an incredible generation gap there. Here's a clip where Mary confronts her boss, Lou Grant, after learning that a male colleague with the same job earns more money than she does. And Lou tells Mary that the man has a family to support, and she doesn't, and she should come back when she has an answer to that.
Because financial need has nothing to do with it. Because in order to be consistent with what you're saying, you would have to pay the man with three children more than the man with two children. And the married man more than the bachelor and Mr. Grant. You don't do that. So what possible reason can you give me for not paying me at least as much as the man who had this job before me?
She's laying it right down there. But to your young students, I guess male and female, Stephanie, you said too cute, too nervous, too timid. She didn't sound timid right there.
No. And this was a couple of years into the show, and they got her more and more, assertive. So I think what my students didn't understand is that, you see, nowadays, men don't feel they have to be Brad Pitt to succeed. I mean, mm-hmm. Mary Tyler Moore was so cute, so charming. There was this sense that she was getting doors open to her because she was that, not because she had a right to it. The show itself was very strong about rights, and they got stronger and stronger as it went on. But my students failed to put it in the context that most of us experienced this show. Donna Reed vacuuming in her pearls and high heels. Messages like Father Knows Best about how you'd be crazy to go out and try to get a job when you could put a dress on and wait for the boy who had the job to to take you out. And actually the reality of a world where, when that started, it was still legal to have help wanted female, help wanted male. So she was taking what had been a male's job. So for those of us who experienced the tremendous, tremendous cultural and practical weight of the discrimination against women, she was just an amazing role model, especially because she was in her 30s, which was just, there were less than 10% of women age 25 to 30 were single still. This was an age when you were just expected to get married, and that was the rest of your life. So she was very important, but I think it's a sign of how far women have come in their expectations that it took my students quite a while to understand why she was so important.
You remind us that Mary Tyler Moore went off the air in 1977, and that was the same year that the D.C. Circuit and other courts ruled an employer could not fire someone for refusing sexual advances.
That's right. So she was on the air 7 years, and on that job, 7 years before most women who were working had those kind of rights.
Showed men coming around, too. Here's Lou Grant in this episode, where giving Mary responsibility to hire a sportscaster. She picks a woman, a former Olympic swimmer. Problem is, the woman only reports on swimming. Turns out to be a flop. Lou reprimands Mary for the decision, but also tells her she struck a blow for women's equality.
Well, you proved that a woman deserves a chance to be just as lousy in a job as a man.
Well, that's right. I did do that.
And that another woman has the right to make a rotten decision and to hire that incompetent woman who does such a lousy job.
Right.
That was his insight. But to go right back to the beginning, the most iconic scene from the whole show, maybe, he asked her questions. Women sometimes face in job interviews but are not legal, like her age and marital status, and then we get to spunk.
Look, miss, would you try answering the questions as I ask them?
Yes, Mr. Grant, I will, but it does seem that you've been asking a lot of very personal questions that don't have a thing to do with my qualifications for this job.
You know what? You got spunk.
Well, yes.
I hate spunk.
Hate spunk, or maybe in a woman in those days. Did your young students finally come around here, Stephanie, or was it Greek to them?
Absolutely, absolutely. They watched a few of the other sitcoms that those of us who were in our late 20s in 1970 had been watching when we were in high school and even in college, and they were like, oh my gosh, now we see what it meant to you. And I think that's such an important thing. I mean, with Mary Tyler Moore's death, it's another opportunity to remind us what we ought to think of more often, just how bad it was. And we have come a long, long way, but we still need to defend it. This has been a very recent gain for women, and it's therefore still a little fragile. So I think that's an important thing to remember now.
Actress Mary Tyler Moore, dead this week at 80, but she pulled off that depiction. Stephanie Kuntz at the Evergreen State College, thank you so much for being with us, Stephanie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. And sayonara, Mary Tyler Moore. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.